You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
And I'd like to welcome you to our forum on Rethinking Responsible Innovation. We will be archiving today's discussion, so anyone who wishes to listen to the recording will have the opportunity to do so at our website, brookings.edu. We know that our well-being as a society is linked to innovation. In fact, fostering innovation has become a national imperative because we recognize its necessity for economic growth, public health, and national security. It is hard to imagine any individual or organization involved in innovation whose ultimate aim is other than the betterment of humanity, even if not explicitly stated. However, in spite of good intentions, the history of innovation is rich of instances in which unanticipated consequences have posed very serious risks. It begs the question of who is responsible for that for those consequences, and how should we structure responsibility in the innovation system? Advocating for responsible innovation requires from us to clear some of the vagueness of the term. After all, as Jack Stilgo puts it, no one seems to be advocating for the opposite, for irresponsible stagnation. Richard Owen and his co-authors offer a useful definition. Responsible innovation is a collective commitment of care for the future through responsive stewardship of science and innovation in the present. This definition involves four dimensions. Anticipatory, which is a disposition towards uncertainty. At an earlier stage, science and technology the impacts of science and technology cannot be predicted, or the methods of prediction are insufficient when we have immense uncertainty about the paths of evolution of a particular technology. The anticipatory disposition proposes an alternative to prediction in imagining plausible futures and using that imagination to engage in a serious debate about possible consequences, developing a societal capacity to deal and cope with consequences as well as shape the trajectory of the evolution of technologies. The second dimension is reflective with respect to underlying motivations, assumptions, and potential impacts. The third is deliberative, opening up a debate on technological developments to stakeholders, particularly to stakeholders that have been traditionally excluded from the decisions in the development of technology. And a fourth is responsive, and they define it as an iterative process of adaptive learning, where there is a reflexivity about the impacts and directions that technological development is taking. The conversation today will focus on some critical aspects of responsible innovation, namely the governance of emerging technologies, the methods and considerations in the evaluation of R&D, particularly at the federal agency level, and considerations of investment that go beyond simply acquiring a return on the investment. We hope with this discussion to shed light on how is responsibility for the consequences of innovation divided among the participants of the innovation system? What kinds of institutions and strategies can be adopted to promote a more responsible innovation system? This morning, we are joined by three distinguished guests. Bennett Freeman is Senior Vice President for Sustainability Research and Policy at Calvert Investments, the largest family of mutual funds dedicated to sustainability and social responsibility, with nearly $12 billion in assets under management. Before the private sector, Bennett worked at the State Department in various positions, the last of which was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. He is also a board member of several distinguished organizations, including Global Witness, the Institute for Human Rights and Business, the Global Network Initiative, and he served as well in the past on the board of Oxfam America. David Chu is the president of the Institute for Defense Analysis. IDA is a nonprofit corporation operating in the public interest. housing a team of about 1,000 scientists and technologists, and includes three federally funded research and development centers dedicated to the analysis of national security issues, and one of them in particular dedicated to science and technology policy. David served in the Department of Defense as Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, and earlier as Assistant Secretary of Defense and Director for Program Analysis and Evaluation. Before the Department of Defense, David was Assistant Director of the Congressional Budget Office for National Security and International Affairs. He is a member of the Defense Science Board and a Fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration. He is also recipient of several medals and awards for distinguished public service, including those from the Department of Defense, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of the Army, the Department of the Navy, and the National Academy of Public Administration. David Guston is Professor of Politics and Global Studies and is the co-director of the Consortium for Science, Policy, and Outcomes at Arizona State University. He is also the principal investigator and director of the Center for Nanotechnology in Society at Arizona State University, funded by the National Science Foundation for roughly $13 million over 10 years, between 2005 and 2015. His book, Between Politics and Science, was awarded the 2002 Don K. Prize by the American Political Science Association for Best Book in Science and Technology Policy, and his papers are among the most cited in the field. He is also a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Let me begin with a question to David Guston. David, at the Center for Nanotechnology in Society, you and your team have developed, tested, and implemented new approaches in the governance of emerging technologies. From that perspective, how would you describe the key ingredients of responsible innovation?
Thank you very much, Walter, for the kind introduction and for this opportunity to address the audience and talk about responsible innovation. So, as Walter said, the Center for Nanotechnology and Society at ASU is funded by the National Science Foundation to look at the societal aspects, the ethical, legal, social questions that emerging technologies like nanotechnology offer us. And one of the first questions that I often get when I tell people about this center and what I do is, well, you know, how do you study something that hasn't happened yet? An emerging technology like nano, where many of its applications are in front of us rather than, you know, simply the things that we have on our pants or our ties or in our golf clubs and tennis rackets. And it basically, this approach that we have, a vision that we call anticipatory governance, has at its core the development of three different kinds of capacities. One that you alluded to is something that we call anticipation. And as you described, basically a shared vision with these folks in England, Richard Owen at Business School at Exeter, who's developed this idea of responsible innovation somewhat in conjunction with us, that you very much like scientists and engineers have been saying since very early on, it is impossible to predict the course of scientific and technical inquiry, and therefore it's sort of doubly difficult to predict the societal consequences of what comes out of scientific and technical inquiry. But that doesn't mean that emerging technologies like nano, like synthetic biology, like geoengineering, are, because they're unpredictable, ungovernable. Because there are other dispositions that we can take than prediction toward these things that we're doing. And Walter very briefly introduced this concept of anticipation, which sort of etymologically, if you think about it, is different than foresight or prediction, which involve sensing a single future that is out there and evaluating your ability to predict by looking for conformity between what you say now and what actually unfolds in the future. Instead, the capacity that we're after is one in which we generate, through informed imagination, if you will, a variety of futures. Because in the present, we have a multiplicity of futures that are conditioned by, on the one hand, things that, you know, the path dependencies that we're existing with, but the choices that we make now and in the future. And anticipation is about, if you think, again, think about it etymologically, it's anticapere, it's building a capacity in a logically prior, not necessarily temporally, prior way. And so what we're interested in is looking at a variety of futures that emerging technologies might hold and acting in the present against that, if you will, backdrop of a variety of futures. So that's one, and we make that concrete by engaging in a method of scenario development where we bring in the scientists and engineers who are doing the nanotechnology development and innovation, a variety of stakeholders, social scientists like myself. And when we have these scenario development workshops with scientists and engineers, it turns out that we end up seeing a change in the way the research is done in the laboratory. And so in one instance with partners at the Biodesign Institute at Arizona State University, after one of these scenario development workshops, one of the graduate students who was working on the identification of a particular disease biomarker in the blood decided to change the biomarker that she was looking for, because the one that she had been looking for was for a disease for which there was currently no known treatment. And she thought it would better conform to her ideas of what it meant to do socially responsible research, and perhaps broader ideas as well, if she instead looked for a marker that could distinguish between viral infection and bacterial infection. Similarly, the lab director in that exercise sort of reoriented his strategic approach in part based on the information that he gleaned from this scenario development workshop that looked at, you know, how the technology that he imagined developing would be developed. A second area that we try to develop, a second capacity that we try to build, is what we call integration. And it involves sort of like the example that I gave you, but in a slightly different form, bringing social scientists and humanists into the science and engineering laboratory to integrate knowledge across the science and engineering and social science and humanities. And we do that not through, say, putting an ethicist in a laboratory and saying, no, 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 you're doing that wrong, or having the ethicist be a resource for scientists and engineers who might say, gee, am I doing this right? But instead, the social scientist or the humanist comes into the laboratory and asks, sort of engages in a Socratic dialogue, asks, what are you doing? Why are you doing it? How could you do it differently? Who might be affected by the choices that you're making in the laboratory? And the idea is to envision and open up the laboratory as a place where governance happens, as a place where people are making consequential decisions for the rest of society. And so that transition of understanding, you know, previously the laboratory as, in essence, a closed space where scientists and engineers make autonomous decisions that only affect themselves and their colleagues, to a place where, as we know, decisions in the laboratory are in fact consequential for the way innovations get rolled out, for the way risks or benefits are embodied in particular technologies, to have that discussion in the context of the laboratory rather than afterward. Third, a capacity for public engagement, to allow dialogues among scientists and engineers and the general public, and to allow the public to really engage in a more robust fashion in the values-based conversations that help set research trajectories, particularly with emerging technologies, when the capacities of those technologies are not yet apparent, and when we're making investment decisions that are not necessarily based on high scientific expertise, but that are based on instead the kinds of goals and values we want those technologies to embody. So those three things, the anticipation, the integration, the engagement, are the capacities that we're trying to build in pursuit of this vision of anticipatory governance of emerging technologies and help constitute responsible innovation in that way.
Thank you, David. That's very illuminating. Let me now move on to David Chu and ask you. Well, you have a vast experience directing program evaluation at the Department of Defense. Evaluation is a key activity for assessing the consequences of research and development investments. it's a key place to make these considerations, and where the R&D process can be held accountable to public concerns as well. There is a clear sense of direction in the Department of Defense. Resources are to be put in the service of the mission. In the current evaluation of R&D, the current practices and methods, are consequences assessed beyond the service of the mission? For instance, are future civilian applications considered, or environmental impact?
Well, Walter, let me join David in thanking you for the chance to be part of this panel this morning. And in response to your question, I think I'd reframe it from my original academic discipline's perspective, because I think the issue you're raising is the one of externalities. So the Defense Department or national security entities undertake research in order to further their mission success. The issue you're raising, do they think about the effects on the larger society, positive or negative, of pursuing those technologies? And the short answer is yes. Thought is given to that. But as David argued, it's very hard to predict what those effects might be. And let me offer three examples. Some cases, the application is straightforward. Prosthetics is an example. You know, so a great deal of effort is made in the current conflict to improve prosthetics. Obvious transfer to the civil sector. Whether the civil sector is willing to pay for prosthetics of that expense is another matter, but the technology is available and it's truly liberating for the affected individual. But I'll offer you two other examples where it's much harder to predict. So your cell phone today depends on GPS, the global positioning system. That was a system approved as the Carter administration was going out of office, not because anyone thought it had great mission value at the time. It had some for navigational purposes, but because, as I understand legend, they thought the next administration was going to expand defense investment and might as well include this on the list. Well, the civil applications of this, as you all appreciate, are extraordinary. Used for farming, used for all sorts of geolocation possibilities, now being used for the air traffic control system and so on and so forth. But you could not have predicted that in January of 1981 when that system was approved for defense development and deployment. I'll give you an older example, which I personally can join those in David's community who can't predict what's going to happen, and that's ARPANET. I was at a research institution with one of the first nodes, ARPANET. I remember when it arrived, it was to be used to move data around, and we all viewed it as an expensive toy, that this had no real practical effect. Of course, it's the basis of the Internet, and that institution actually worked on packet switching, and to its eternal regret, did not take out a patent in order to enhance its development possibilities. So it's very hard to anticipate those larger consequences, as David argued. And I think there's a risk, coming to the governance issue that David raised, there's a risk if you give too much weight in the evaluative process to purposes outside the mission of the bureaucratic agency, because you invite speculation about benefits that that agency may not be in a good position to anticipate and weigh properly in the calculus. And I do see that in decision-making within bureaucratic organizations where I've been privileged to serve. People will wave their hands at generalized social benefit in order to get past the fact that in terms of that agency's mission, this is a lower priority investment. And I'll offer you two examples that are controversial in character. One, contemporary, which is a matter of dissension between the legislative and executive branches of the government, and that's the Navy's Green Fleet effort. So Secretary Mabus, Navy Secretary, has promoted the idea that the Navy should help bring the price down of alternative fuels. And the Congress has actually tried to prohibit that on the grounds that that's not his mission and that they're not that good at it. This is Department of Energy's mission. There's another example that's been going on for some time with mixed results, I would argue, some very beneficial, and that's medical R&D that is not really oriented toward military problems. Mm-hmm. This really started when Jody Ferraro was a member of Congress, and she got in the late 80s breast cancer research money in the defense appropriation. Mm-hmm. That led to a fight between the Army, which was the recipient, and the NIH, which felt it should administer the program. The Army said, no, it's our money, we're going to administer it. Now, legend is, this turned out well, that the Army listened to the breast cancer victims and changed the course of research and the emphasis given to that. So that's a happy example. But on the other hand, it is now the case, typically year in, year out, defense gets $500 million, not a trivial sum of money, of R&D for purposes that the Congress thinks are meritorious. They weren't necessary purposes the administration, NIH, the other science establishments thought were the right place to put funds. And while the recipients view it as free money, it is not free money out of the national security function of the budget. What the Congress does is it pluses up these accounts. So breast cancer, the men are there too, prostate cancer is funded now, AIDS research, it's a whole long list of things that receive money. But it's financed not with extra appropriations, it's financed by undistributed reductions to other defense accounts. You create two problems. One is you put an agency that's really not the one charged with that mission in our federal organization in charge. And second, you create an inefficiency within its operation because somebody has to cut something else that was part of the president's budget request in order to fund this. Congress hides it with undistributed reduction matter. I think what I would argue is that if you want to take account of these externalities, going back to the economics perspective, in an agency decision-making, you want to think carefully about what incentives you wish to create for the agency to do so and what weight you want to place on those incentives. And you want to watch over time whether those incentives are producing the results that you desire and undertake course corrections accordingly. So long-winded answer, sort of maybe is the right perspective on this, but I would urge caution about doing too much of it.
Thank you, David. Let me move now on to Bennett and discuss a very, very important aspect of innovation that sometimes falls outside of the scope of the discussion of responsible innovation, but nevertheless is critical. Responsible capital investment can influence innovation at various stages of firm maturity. It introduces powerful incentives for startup companies to make early choices about technological development that are consistent with values such as sustainability or good citizenship. For established firms, responsible innovation funds can act as a check on corporate responsibility, where the fund manager organizes feedback from shareholders or gives public voice to the concerns of shareholders, possibly influencing policy too. Bennett, could you tell us more about this emerging model of capital investment?
Sure.
Specifically, where do you see trade-offs for firms and investors? And what is the potential for growth of responsible investment?
Sure. Well, thank you. Thank you, Walter. A pleasure to be back at Brookings and to be on the panel with both Davids here. Investment has long been associated, and I think rightly so, with innovation. And for all of the disruptions in U.S. capital, and for that matter, global capital markets over the last several years in particular, I think we can look back at a 20th century and an early 21st century of innovation in capital markets in terms of their growing capacity to handle high volume, high frequency trades, their relative transparency, their ability to ward off new threats such as cyber attacks. I think that there's a lot to be credited when it comes to innovation in our capital markets. Some of the innovations of the last decade or two in particular, I wouldn't exactly characterize as being responsible innovation. I'm thinking of the opaqueness of complex derivatives, and I'm particularly thinking of the what some would consider even the mendacity of subprime mortgages and the misleading ways in which they were marketed both to recipients and to investors. I hope we've learned some lessons. And some of those lessons, not enough of them, I think, are embodied in Dodd-Frank, which is only now slowly beginning to be implemented. But what I'd like to call attention to in terms of your question, Walter, is the emerging trend towards responsible investment which has been underway for several decades. Calvert is not alone as a so-called socially responsible investment firm. In our case, we've been at it for three decades. There are a couple smaller peers or competitors of ours who've been at it for four decades. Certainly, we all equate venture capital and to some extent private equity with innovation. And indeed, some venture capital in the environmental space in particular with responsible investment. But what we do at Calvert, together with our peers and importantly, together with a growing number of larger institutional asset managers, is to take investment approaches with public companies, which we own in our case exclusively, so with public companies, which we think embodies responsible investment and indeed a form of responsible innovation. And for us, that innovation plays out in two categories. First, our products, the actual investment themes of various funds and the construction of those funds, and secondly, the engagement and indeed shareholder advocacy and public policy initiatives that we undertake that I think are innovative, and I think others have recognized them as such. In Calvert's case, turning first quickly to our products, we have, without making this a commercial about Calvert, we've got about 40 plus mutual funds that apply comprehensive environmental, social, and governance criteria, and we will only invest in companies that demonstrate reasonable standards around environment, climate change, labor and human rights, basic corporate governance, those factors that have become much more mainstream concerns for investors and indeed across corporate America the last decade or so as the so-called corporate social responsibility agenda has become so mainstream. In our case, we've also developed a couple of funds with very distinct sustainability themes tied explicitly to innovation in particular sectors, which we think is responsible, but not only responsible in terms of the societal and global needs we're trying to address, the sustainability challenges we're trying to help solve, but also in terms of generating reasonable returns to our shareholders. We put up in 2007 a global alternative energy fund, which along with that whole sector has had more than its share of struggles, particularly as it was its investment premise was tied to some extent to certain expectations around public policy, finally setting a uniform price on carbon. But we remain hopeful that that some of those log jams are being resolved, if not in the U.S. at the federal level, increasingly at the state level with states like California. We have a global water fund, which is a perfect marriage between addressing a global sustainability challenge and an investment opportunity by focusing on companies that provide efficient metering for water use, clean filtration systems, and desalination technologies that will help address the global growing global scarcity of fresh water. We just launched a few months ago what we think is the first ever emerging market sustainability fund, where we invest in companies based in emerging markets that operate both in emerging markets as well as in the so-called frontier markets and offer sustainability solutions, whether in the environmental or climate context or labor and human rights or empowerment of women and girls, to name just a few of the criteria. So there's a trend, I think, that on the product side, and we see it with other firms, certainly the firm run by Al Gore and David Blood Generation embodies this trend towards more responsible, sustainable investment, in their case around a smaller core portfolio of about 40 companies that provide sustainability solutions. I would call attention to a particular company I especially familiar with for various reasons, that of the so-called large caps, I think now embodies responsible innovation as much as any. And it's interestingly a company whose whole history has been characterized by innovation, but not always the most responsible forms of innovation, and that's General Electric. With the Echo Imagination platform now, far more than a brand marketing platform. Indeed, it's a suite of environmental technology products and services that have already generated over $20 billion of revenue for the company, particularly in markets like China, and fueled by GE's R&D capabilities, as well as its massive capital capabilities as well. I'll just end quickly by mentioning, though, innovation around engagement in public policy. And one doesn't necessarily always associate investors with public policy engagement. We're well known for our shareholder advocacy of introducing pesky resolutions and annual meetings, as we certainly do with the best of them. But you wouldn't have expected a number of investors, half a dozen or so, joining with human rights NGOs, with internet giants like Yahoo, Google, Microsoft, and now Facebook, in something called the Global Network Initiative, which sets a global standard for how internet companies should deal with freedom of expression and right to privacy issues, which are becoming all the more acute in an era of growing surveillance and censorship on the internet. Nor would you expect, in our case, an investment firm to be a prime supporter of provisions of Dodd-Frank beyond basic reforms of the capital markets. We supported Dodd-Frank 1502 that requires companies to disclose efforts to identify and curtail use of so-called conflict minerals in their supply chains that have fueled the conflict in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And interestingly, together with some of the leading companies, HP, AMD, Intel, Ford Motor, and GE, coming together with responsible investors and human rights NGOs to champion that legislation. Likewise, we at Calvert came together with Oxfam America and Global Witness and other NGOs to support Dodd-Frank 1504, which requires oil and gas and mining companies to disclose revenue payments to governments of countries where they operate around the world as a way to address the so-called resource curse, all the corruption that flows from oil, gas, and mineral revenue, but from our point of view, gives us greater transparency around what we think are material risks to investors. So I'll just close by observing that it's great that, you know, we've been doing responsible investment in our corner of the investment marketplace for many years. I'm delighted that I think it's become increasingly innovative and cooperative with other sectors. But the really important point is that we're now seeing large institutional asset managers begin to embrace what they call ESG, environmental, social, and governance factors, of both on the risk and opportunity side. And when we can make responsible investment the coin of the realm, and not just for the Calverts of the world, but for the UBSs and the Goldman Sachs and the JP Morgan Chases, then we're going to really make a difference. And I think that that horizon is open to us in the coming years.
Thank you, Bennett. The conversation so far has taken on illuminated aspects of the key institutions and organizations of innovation. Activities in the university for responsible innovation, activities at the agency level, as David Chu spoke of, and activities in the private sector, and also of consumers and investors. At the same time, I realize you were speaking, the three of you, of David, institutional design and institutions, David, of incentives, which was a key of understanding the role of the agency in this, and interest and values, particularly on firms and investors. These are three central concepts in understanding responsible innovation. I'd like to follow up on. Let me start with a follow up on the one that is most difficult, perhaps, to understand. It is when these values, when an investor is concerned about things like sustainability, or making sure that the company that they are patronizing is following certain basic practices. Of the law in the United States that could possibly be transgressed abroad and in a factory abroad. When the investor is looking into these other values, in addition to the profit on its investment, it is creating a or accepting a certain balance between the different values. Not necessarily that they won't get a return on investment, but for those investors who have not yet taken that set of considerations. From your experience, Bennett, how do you deal with the reluctance of or fear to inform investment decisions by values other than profitability?
Right. Look, we wouldn't have been in business for over three decades if we didn't provide solid returns. That's not to say that every fund that we run, or for that matter, everybody else runs, is always outperforming its benchmark. That's just not how the investment world works. There's plenty of ups and downs, but our view is that we do provide solid returns. Certainly, the large number of our 4- and 5-star funds, according to Morningstar, confirm that. But sure, there's a lingering perception on the part of some that there's some give back by investing according to some consideration of environmental, social, and governance criteria. I can tell you in our case, though, that we don't make the investment decisions purely based on a company's positive environmental or human rights commitment or performance. We make the investment decisions based on an increasingly integrated analysis of how the financials, near-term, medium-term, long-term prospects of the company add up while taking into account environmental, social, and governance risks or opportunities, which may be salient for some companies in some sectors and not for others. But we look at environmental, social, and governance risk and opportunity in ways that other investors are catching up to, and I think it allows us to see around corners and over horizons. I'll just give a quick example to make the point, you know, not to claim great credit on this, but we were looking pretty closely a few years ago, in 2008, at BP, which people don't remember now, you know, given Deepwater Horizon, but under Lord Brown, was remarkably innovative within the industry of, you know, breaking the crockery on climate change and supporting cap and trade and investing some billions in alternative energy and being a leader in human rights in the oil industry, which sounds like an oxymoron, doing human rights risk assessments, championing extractive revenue transparency long before Dodd-Frank 1504. We took a real close look at them, with a willingness, even in the so-called socially responsible investment space, to invest in a big global oil company. Well, we felt we came short, and we decided not to go there because we examined the company's safety record over the couple of years after the Texas City disaster in 2005, and we were dissatisfied by their not just addressing that particular site, but by a lack of full systematic review of safety on a global basis. We made that determination in 2008. Deepwater Horizon happened in 2010. We didn't predict Deepwater Horizon, but our analysis told us that this was a company at unreasonable risk of another disaster. So by looking at those kinds of factors, we are able, I think, to make a difference for our shareholders, sometimes on the downside, sometimes on the upside.
Great. again, the concepts that we identify as institutions, incentives, and values. And I'd like to ask David Chu a key question of something that you said about how to induce agencies to take on considerations outside the very agency mission would have to do with the incentives presented to the agency. And this, of course, you speak from your experience on DOD, but and the Department of Defense, but applies to almost all bureaucracies. The jurisdiction of an agency is sacred land to be protected by the agency. And of course, taking considerations outside that jurisdiction is a gamble. What kinds of incentives do you envision that could possibly expand the scope of considerations that an agency does when promoting innovation?
Well, you're absolutely right to focus on turf as a bureaucratic issue. I would offer two suggestions. One's bureaucratic. I think this role is quintessentially why you have an Office of Management and the Budget. And you really want to, in my estimation, in a non-market organization, which is what the government is, vest looking out for issues beyond the agency charter in some oversight office that can look across the government's whole. And I think our history would argue better off if agencies stick to their last, so to speak, and not venture too far outside their area of competence, because you get sort of lopsided investments, too much in something that is not going to pay off. They don't really understand the various factors involved where they should. The other suggestion I make would go down really at the bottom to the incentives facing the individual researcher or technology manager. And I'll just mention one of the interesting things about at least the government laboratories in the Department of Defense is the laboratory staff can own some degree of rights, patent rights, in the innovations that they produce. Now, it's carefully governed, and there are rules about this, et cetera. But I think that gives the individual researcher, which is ultimately, I think, where some of the more interesting ideas about application may reside, an interest, so to speak, within some limits, about the application of that technology or that idea to the larger whole. And so I would, my own prescriptive advice would be to avoid the middle. Don't have the agency head busy thinking about how his agency or her agency can help some other agency do its business necessarily, or at least as a first principle. But make sure that the actors within the agency are sensitive to some of the issues out there so that they help warn, because they're better attuned to what that technology might produce, both positive and negative in character. So watch out for what incentive set the individual researcher or focused program manager faces. And then at the government-wide position, charge OMB. And to some extent, I'm indicting OMB for not playing more of this role and not watching out more for these larger issues. Instead, in many administrations, in the Clinton administration, OMB in that period was well known in some circles for intervening in what agents consider microscopic issues.
Yep.
But watch out for these big trade-off questions.
Yeah.
Right.
Are we putting, you look across the R&D effort in topic X, are we as a government putting our money where it ought to go, and are we asking the various agencies that have some competence or some potential contribution in the area to make appropriate investments, yes or no, and to play that strategic role really, in the government?
Indeed.
Precisely, the incentive you want to confront the R&D director with, so that he or she shines in history, is a judgment as to whether they help manage the technology portfolio in a useful way.
Yeah.
And indeed, some of the incentives of which you speak at the researcher level were introduced by Stevenson Wadler that allow government scientists
employees
to take title, well, the agency to take title to patents, but then share a certain amount of royalties from the licensing of those patents to employees of these federal laboratories. Yes, a macro solution at the government executive level, one at the micro level. Perhaps there's David, Gustin, I'll turn to you for you spoke about anticipatory governance and the process within. In a sense, it looked like institutional design that you had tested in a confined space of the university had a measure of success. Can I invite you to speculate on how to scale up this success? And if we can envision this being made available at the organizational level, at the middle level.
So part of the initial impetus for the design of the Center for Nanotechnology and Society at ASU came many years before its funding, when it was clear, say, in the late 90s, early 2000s, that Congress was never going to get around to reappropriating for an Office of Technology Assessment, and trying to envision what instead a distributed capacity to do a sort of engaged technology assessment might look like. Mm-hmm. And the recognition that universities had been in the innovation business for a long time, not just since Bayh-Dole invited them formally to partake in profit sharing from intellectual property, but extending all the way back to the middle 19th century and agricultural extension and things of that sort, and vitamin D at Wisconsin, and so on. So universities had been in this innovative business for a long time. And over time, particularly in the sort of second the final quarter of the 20th century, the federal government had got around to encouraging university innovation to be, if you will, more responsible and more responsive to social concerns in a particular set of ways. And so it wasn't until the early 1970s that, at the instigation of the federal government, universities started seriously taking human subjects protection into consideration, the establishment of institutional review boards to protect human subjects. And then second, as you well know, in 1980 and thereafter, the encouragement of universities to engage in greater participation in economic development through Bayh-Dole and the follow-on technology transfer legislation. And, you know, these were, in the sort of responsive sense of responsibility, quite important changes in the way university innovation happened. But I think we could probably all agree, even though responsibility is a somewhat gaseous term sometimes, that the responsibility of scientists and innovators goes beyond not harming research subjects and contributing to the local economy. And so what I envision is, in essence, parallel to institutional review boards at universities, parallel to the offices of technology transfer that universities have set up in response to Bayh-Dole, that universities also establish what could be called centers for responsible innovation that would be, in essence, you know, their own cognates of the kind of center that, under NSF sponsorship, we've developed at Arizona State. And if you, you know, recall what Walter said in introduction, this was a serious investment by NSF at ASU in one center that really, you know, if you were to ask me, it was, you know, even too, as generous as this was in funding social science at ASU, it was too small to do the job. But, you know, one potential funding mechanism for this, not to rely on NSF, is in actually, to go back to OMB, because it does have this sort of cross-cutting role. And OMB sets the requirements for what universities can charge the government for indirect costs on the grants and contracts that they receive to do research and development. And so a certain share of the university's electricity, a certain share of its library, a certain share of its research administration goes back to the federal government to be charged as indirect rather than direct costs onto the grant. And so one might imagine that if this idea of responsible innovation were a serious enough one, the government could, through executive order and working through the Office of Management and Budget, change and add on the idea that research oriented toward the societal aspects, the responsible innovation aspects of the research that the university is itself doing, could be in part charged to the indirect cost account. And that would be a flow of funds that could, at least at large research universities, support significant amount of reflexive research in the context of work that is already going on. Another kind of instrument that I think is really important is being able to think about linking up the decisions, as I mentioned, thinking about the laboratory as a site of governing decisions, thinking about linking up the decisions that scientists and engineers are making in the laboratory with the kind of socially responsible investment decisions that Bennett is talking about. And one tool to do this is known as life cycle analysis or life cycle assessment, where you look at a product and don't just imagine that, for example, because it's nanotechnology, the product is going to be faster, cheaper, lighter, and therefore more efficient. But look at it across its life cycle from the places where they're excavating the materials out of the earth and paying people or not paying people very well in order to do it, to where these materials are going to go when they're disposed of, and what kind of impact they're going to have on their disposal. And so, you know, colleagues of mine at ASU are working on, for example, working on a life cycle assessment of carbon nanotubes. Okay, things that are known as buckyballs and fullerenes, and you know, they're long, they're nanoscale, meaning 10^-9 meters, very small. And the balls look like little soccer balls. The tubes look like something that you might see at a playground. And they're incredibly useful and potentially in a large number of applications, including in batteries that could have a higher capacity to store charge and the ability to discharge that charge over a longer period of time and could be incredibly efficient things. Problem is, it takes an enormous amount of energy right now to make these things in the laboratory, and we haven't figured out how to scale up that production well enough at a lower energy level, such that you'd actually save energy by making the batteries based on the amount of energy that has to go into making the carbon nanotubes. Okay, so there's a concrete consideration around nanotech that this life cycle perspective kind of encourages. How much energy has to go in order to get this anticipated benefit of energy savings out? Similarly, with things like using new nanomaterials for catalysis and the replacement of expensive materials like platinum, you know, that would lead us to cheaper reactions, cheaper fuel cells because they're relying on this expensive material. But there are a whole host of people in South Africa in particular who rely on mining platinum for their livelihood. Okay? So what considerations are brought to the broader social context in our decision to think about replacing platinum and removing a major market for these people who are living as subsistence miners in South Africa? A third kind of example, titanium. Which goes, you know, titanium dioxide is one of the major nanomaterials and goes on everything from your sunscreens to your powdered donuts in either micro or nano form. And, you know, there's, again, this is one of the major suppliers of titanium is Kenya, I believe. And what are the conditions that these folks are producing this material whose demand is only going to increase? And are we increasing that demand based on these nano applications on the backs of people who are living sort of miserable subsistence mining lives?
Great. I can see that idea of the Center for Responsible Innovation embedded in the universities also extending to agencies. If agencies charter centers within themselves, they create they appropriate the idea within the mission itself of the agency. Perhaps, I don't know if David wants to comment, but I also saw Bennett seeing parallelisms with the very process of evaluating an investment that social responsible investment firms would probably have internal review of new investments that they add to the portfolio in the same fashion.
We call it due diligence. you know, and it's that's really what you're getting at, I think. David, as well, looking at some of the social impacts of what goes into nanotechnology. It's interesting you mentioned titanium, which is one of the so-called conflict minerals that's been fueling the conflict in the Congo. Platinum is also one that's been quite troubling in South Africa because, on the one hand, as you point out, it's one of the major minerals mined in the country whose economy still has a significant dependence on that industry, both for low-paid artisanal mining, but also for higher-paid unionized mining. Yet at the same time, platinum mining is well known to be notoriously unsafe. And in fact, Anglo American, the largest platinum miner in the world with huge operations in South Africa, has on and off again shut platinum mines in that very country. So, you know, it's fascinating, you know, to hear you talk, because I do see overlaps among our issues. And I would also add that at Calvert, we've begun over the last several years to look at nanotechnologies, social and environmental implications, not least in food and beverage and retail packaging, all kinds of applications. And we're just beginning to get a grip on what some of those implications are for responsible investment.
Yeah. And if I may follow up, and being able to allow scientists and engineers who are making design choices and making materials choices in the laboratory to be informed by that before they make choices that lock in the innovations that they're creating, I think is critically important. And so, you know, you don't get a situation where now we have, you know, an entire subdiscipline of green chemistry that in essence is trying to undo a century and a half of path dependencies created by choices that people have made in the laboratory, where they're doing chemical reactions in a particular way, in a particularly unsustainable way, because that's simply the way they were taught. And that's the way the person who taught them was taught.
Yep.
Indeed. David, you wanted to say something?
I do think one has to be a little careful about those whose expertise may be limited in anticipating these unintended consequences of charging them with too much responsibility, because there may yet be a further unintended consequence. So let's take the miners that, as Ben pointed out, suffer from, there's the safety issue, but there's the issue of whether that's where you want to have South Africa's working population stuck over time.
Yeah.
And would we be better off working on the underlying issue here, which is the skill set and the economic opportunities confronting South Africa's labor force, as opposed to having the laboratory science worry too much about the material being used here as being somehow off limits or subject to some implicit moral tax. I mean, I tend to come at these issues, I acknowledge from an economist's perspective, but that's what you want the pricing system in some fashion to signal, to roll up these various issues in a single way, so people get the idea. That can be done through placing a tariff on certain kinds of materials. We don't generally have political tariffs, but that may not be impossible in our system. And there are other put it differently. I think there are other ways to address these issues that may be superior to having the scientist worry too much about the unintended effects that he or she may not be a good forecaster. I mean, I do like David's idea that you want to encourage consideration of these issues, but I would urge consideration by parties that actually can accumulate the expertise necessary to offer a better based perspective on what might happen.
Very good. Let's open the panel to questions from the floor. I will have the mic. So starting here in the front, please. The gentleman in the blue shirt.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I have this conversation has raised a lot of questions, two in particular. One is, I was listening to David, the first David, talk about the four elements, I guess you would say, of the innovation management process of anticipatory, reflective, deliberative, responsive, etc. And I wondered to what extent that differs from the concept of, in what ways does it differ and what ways is it similar to the concept that I know a Calvert Fund science advisor, Dr. Kai Lee, has talked about adaptive management. And second, a broader question for the panel,
is we're back here 5 years from now, and to what extent will the I'll call it the onset of big data? What ways do you anticipate that may inform what you are doing now and help you to know things 5 years hence that you don't know today?
Mm-hmm. Before I let David answer the question, let me just clarify that I quoted Richard Owen on those four dimensions of his definition of responsible innovation. So we won't ask David to defend other authors' point, okay. But he may respond to anticipatory governance in relation to what you said.
Yeah.
Right. Adaptive governance.
Yeah, yeah. Richard is a friend and colleague and collaborator of mine. I'm actually happy to defend that, at least in part. I know Kai and his scholarship from when he was an academic and the work, I guess, that he's done with the Packard Foundation. And they're not utterly dissimilar concepts between anticipatory governance and adaptive management. And to some extent, the one anticipatory governance relies on the ability to do adaptive management as things get implemented. But I think anticipatory governance is lodged in a temporally and conceptually prior moment than adaptive management is in recognizing the laboratory as a site of governance opportunities. And in taking this anticipatory prospective disposition. Adaptive management, I think, sort of starts once that interaction of the introduction of the innovation occurs. And we want to start that earlier because there's, let me see if I can, it is off, but, when you concretize something, when this comes to the market and you get to start making those pricing decisions, when consumers make a choice about whether to buy this, I bought this without any information. Some of it probably was available had I really paid attention about, workers in China.
Right.
And that might have helped me make a decision about whether to switch to this thing or not. But once it gets to this stage, the investments that have been made by public and private actors are so enormous that to think about changing it simply through market forces is really, really difficult. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why we have to think about going upstream further and thinking quite seriously about the decisions that get made in the laboratory and then get reified in devices like this. And the point is not to enforce this decision as, a sort of mandatory tax on laboratory research. The approach that we've taken is one that's been sort of inviting of scientists and engineers who are interested in this kind of collaboration, very much the same way that some firms might be interested in, making corporate social responsibility something that is, more, that gains more traction within the firm than greenwashing. And so we have a small group of scientists and engineers, and the idea is to make them more successful and help them outcompete the folks in a relatively competitive environment for federal funds, for investment, and so on. And I think that even, some researchers like to think of the indirect cost as a tax on them, but it, is really about the university when federal funds are given, and I think it could be more appropriately seen as that way. So the distinction with adaptive management is really one about time, but they are compatible and essentially mutually reliable activities with respect to big data, and I'm sure other folks have something to say here, but in some sense, on the one hand, all bets are off. On the other hand, it's not clear whether the tools for accessing big data will be available enough. So if you look at the introduction of electronic health records into hospitals, which is potentially one analog for this, right now you're not seeing a lot of the gains in efficiencies, in health outcomes and so forth, despite the fact that you've got these things institutionalized. The transition costs are enormous. And so 5 years may not be long enough time for folks who are making decisions in a laboratory to figure out what the scope of inputs and outputs might be in a sophisticated and impactful way.
I think actually the current health record example is an excellent one about difficulty of forecasting the effects, because the more careful researchers, you probably are aware, mm-hmm. now demonstrates it's actually increased costs, mm-hmm. In part because it makes available to the physician the earlier records, and the physician is now motivated to get another test mm-hmm. or another look to see how you're doing on that front. And so it actually increased, quite apart from the transition yep. costs, which is not trivial,
yep.
the actual ongoing operating costs are higher, at least according to some recent journal materials, with this industry. But on the big data front, on the one hand, yes, I think there's clearly going to be an opportunity to substitute fact for opinion. In many of these areas, as you know, we're reliant in the past on surveys. People try to remember what they did and tell you what they ate before. Now you can try to monitor the activity. On the other hand, it's obviously, as one can tell from looking at the manipulation of Google rankings, for example, or suppression of adverse information by companies, or promoting their website on the internet, it's possible to manipulate big data. And I think one thing to watch out for is, do we really understand what we have when we have an analysis of these data flows? Or is it being driven by some other set of factors out there that is producing the data elements that we observe?
Mm-hmm. Let's take another question. I saw a hand over here.
Hi, Adam Paris, NOAA. So I really appreciate the conversation around incentives. Incentives are themselves path dependencies, actually. Mm-hmm. So my question isn't so much where you incentivize as what you incentivize. Mm-hmm. Do you incentivize the pursuit of outcomes or attention to governance of research goals or some of the things that some might define as determinants of success, like iterativity and interdisciplinarity and engagement?
Mm-hmm. Anyone want to take that question?
Well, let me try a first round answer. Yes, I think you want to focus on outcomes, not outputs and not inputs. But many of the incentive structures we have in the government are input-oriented. Did you follow the rules? Did you check off this square, et cetera, as opposed to what longer-term effect might you have? And it's been an issue in the financial sector,
yes.
looking at corporate compensation.
Yeah, indeed.
In other words, do we look at the long-term outcome of the executive's actions as opposed to immediate quarterly earnings,
right.
et cetera? I would acknowledge designing those incentives is tricky. And we can see, again, that issue in the corporate sector where people moved away from base compensation to ownership elements,
right.
stock options, that
right.
actually produced results that were
right.
not desirable in character. I would also emphasize that I think you can get a lot out of non-monetary incentives. I think people tend to assume when you say incentive, you're talking about cash. It may be that the prize, for example, Napoleon's famous saying, give me enough women, I can conquer the world. The prize, the contest, coming in first, or your team doing well, recognition by the public may provide very powerful incentives to the kinds of behaviors you wish to encourage. But yes, I think you're right. You want to focus on outcomes and long run outcomes, not just the immediate effect that you might see.
Let's take a question. The gentleman on the with the jacket.
I'm Mark Brodsky. I want to ask David Chu, following up on his incentives, but not so much the incentives. So the incentives for something you don't know that's going to happen is very difficult to use. If you want long-term outcomes and you don't know what they're going to be, it's hard to incentivize those. But to put responsibility on the agencies and the individuals, I want to bring up a strange example, and that's called moral rights in copyright. It's common in European countries, but not in the United States. And it's something that's non-tradable. You can sell your copyright, but you can never sell your moral rights. And typical example is the original copyright owners or their families have prevented colorizing of old movies because they didn't like the idea of their black and white movies changing. Now, if somehow you gave the creators or their agencies even, that's a whole new set of legal framework, mm-hmm. moral rights, that if their creations in the future came out something. And they retained that right long beyond having sold their patent or something. You can have some sort of moral responsibility for how the item is used in the future. For one example comes to mind right now, 3D fabrication. And you worry about guns being made out of that. If some holder of that invention or that agency that provided that technology or the government in general had a moral right on how things could be used, you might prevent, you know, that individual might say, I don't like it being used to make guns, for example. Or if the original creators of packet switching and the internet, you know, somehow had some right to now demand in reverse of what they wanted in the beginning, that people be identified when they send spam or whatever, you know, it might be a different world. I'd like you to comment on somebody retaining the moral right to creations, because you don't know what they're going to be like in the future.
Yes, although I think there's a downside as well, which is if you look at who holds most property rights, patents. So it's largely organizations.
No, see, the law doesn't allow that to happen. If the individual has the moral right, the organization never gets it.
I understand in terms of European structure, but I think the problem that you could create, I mean, it's an interesting possible future, not part of American law, as you point out, but what's another established finding, I think, in the innovation literature on the economic side is that large extent organizations generally try to suppress innovation. They don't foment it. And so I would worry if you create a regime where people can reach forward or back, how you want to look at this, over any decade, say, oh, you can't do that with my thing, that you may, in fact, suppress interesting developments as opposed to avoid adverse consequences, which I think, take the gun example from the 3D printing, that can be dealt with by direct government intervention. And just say you can't do that kind of thing. We do that all the time with various technologies. So you can't use that technology for purpose X, Y, or Z, or we put some tax on it for some other discouragement. I think we're much better off doing that than creating a set of entanglements that may, in fact, preclude progress. Because I go back to David's original comment. Again, from economic sociology, this is Robert Solow's observation decades ago, in terms of trying to look at the relationship between inputs, labor and capital, and economic outputs. And there's this large unexplained residual. And he said, that unexplained residual is technological progress. And I think David's absolutely right. That is the source of improved human opportunities. And I think he'd be very careful about constricting it.
If I may, though, there are some examples in the American context that are cognate to that. And so, for example, when certain stem cell technologies were developed at the University of Wisconsin, they put a certain set of restrictions that were not government mandated on the licensing of those technologies. That, for example, you were not to put human and non-human materials together for development purposes as opposed to research purposes. Okay? And so, you know, that exists, that kind of thing exists at the licensing level, if not at the patenting level. And, you know, given that we encourage universities to partake as, you know, sort of first actors in the innovation system, it's not unreasonable to have robust discussions and even these kinds of policy implementations by universities around the questions of the moral use of technologies.
But if you're going to do that, I would urge you put a sunset clause in, because look, a different area of the law, which is wills and the foundation documents. People put on their gifts various restrictions, which when they impose them seem sensible to society at that time. Mm-hmm. 100 years later, it's no longer a good idea. And we have a big legal issue about can we break that or not. Yeah. So I think if you're going to do that...
Well, the patent expires.
The moral rights is it never expires.
Yeah,
caveat to such a regime would be put a sunset clause in, or some kind of review mechanism. Say, does this still make sense?
Right. A good example of that, in a completely other different sphere, is the wrangle over the disposition of the Barnes Foundation
Yes.
art collection, you know, in Marion, Pennsylvania, and the strictures that he imposed a century ago, which conformed to a certain aesthetic then and, you know, limited accessibility and appreciation now, and yet still was a huge controversy. But I agree with you. I think there needs to be a statute of limitations.
Let's take a question on this side of the... yes, please.
My name is Abdul. Can you hear me?
Speak up.
Yeah. My question is particularly related to anticipatory management and, to some extent, CSR and the incentives you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
A major part of economic development in the world is related to disruptive innovation. And therefore, when you start, when you go so way upstream and start intervening with the process of invention, how do you impact disruptive innovation? And could you produce outcomes that are contrary to your original assumption? In other words, you mentioned the example of South Africa. You mentioned the example of chemistry being path dependent. To break that path dependence, you would want to allow the process of innovation to take its natural course. But yet again, both CSR and the incentives and what you mentioned try to concentrate on outcomes by intervening in the process. How does that impact what you intend to do, particularly contrasting that to theory of stakeholders where people do not concentrate on the outcomes but allow all the different groups to work together, collaborate in the process, and the outcome becomes the outcome?
Yeah. I'll take a quick, just a quick reaction. I'm sure my fellow panelists will have more insightful ones, but you're getting at a really tough problem of how we balance innovation with not only moral considerations, but some degree of public acceptance. And you don't want, on the one hand, you don't want to stifle innovation by conditioning it on wide public acceptance. On the other hand, you know, particularly in the corporate context, brands are quite sensitive to, corporate reputations are quite sensitive to public reaction. And I think that one of the established features, and an overwhelmingly positive one now in the world of 21st century business, is the not just consumer activism or shareholder activism, but the extent to which stakeholders, multiple stakeholders, can make or break a brand or a corporate reputation depending on how they feel about a particular product and the way that it was made. And the example that comes most concretely to mind is the issue around GMOs, genetically modified organisms, which are transforming agriculture and what we eat as consumers around the world, yet at the same time raise for some troubling ethical and moral questions, economic questions in terms of public health and environmental issues, issues around indigenous people's rights, traditional forms of agrarian production, cultural identity bound up in those modes of production. And a lot of us who follow these issues from a corporate responsibility, corporate reputation point of view, were really struck by how Monsanto essentially lost its social license to operate in Europe in the mid to late 90s. They were basically knocked out of the EU. Their CEO lost their job. If I recall correctly, they almost lost the company, which is no small thing for a company of that capitalization at the time. And I was struck, you know, over the weekend by echoes of that with protests against Monsanto over GMOs in about 75 cities around the world, facilitated by a technology that didn't exist in the mid to late 90s, namely social media. So, you know, that, your question is a really incisive one, and not just my fellow panelists, but I'm sure the whole audience could spend the whole day dissecting it and coming up with different angles. But I think that the GMO example is a useful one in that it represents the multifaceted concerns that have to be taken into account as we balance innovation and responsibility.
Do you want to? Okay. So a dear colleague of mine has, as his email sign-off, the statement, I don't know to whom it's attributed, but the unexamined life is not worth living. The examined life makes you want to shoot yourself.
That's great.
Is it Woody Allen? Okay.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Makes sense. And so, it goes to the point that none of these things are solutions per se. But they're ways of making life worth living, not just for the people who are doing the innovation, but for the people on the rest of the planet as well. And the sort of normative perspective that I draw on for this is one from a political scientist named Langdon Winner, who almost 40 years ago, wrote a book called Autonomous Technology, where he equated legislation with innovation, because both of these things are normally performed by a small elite group of actors in society and help create the structures through which the rest of us live our lives and pursue our versions of the good. And he said, if you believe that there should be some normative constraints, particularly around participation and representation with legislation, then you should also believe that you should have those things around innovation. And people following on developed then the obvious slogan, no innovation without representation. I think that is both quite observant and in many ways quite true, that people make stuff from the very earliest kinds of technologies that help define us as people to the most complicated things that exist as, these wonderful scientific and technical and cultural icons. People make stuff, but the stuff that we make reflects back on us in the same way that we have to live with the laws that we make. And thinking about those as similar kinds of apparatus in society, I think, leads us to think of similar ways in which we can all participate in the making and the governing of the world.
I'll take a question from the very back.
Thank you. I work in the area of ethics and healthcare, particularly with providers, and you raised an issue that I'm very acutely aware of related to electronic health records, electronic medical records. And I was hoping, as you pointed out, your awareness of the big data issues related to that and the huge burdens in this transition, which seems to be a very long and ongoing, what kind of guidance can you give about how this is going to work? I mean, I work with the providers who are basically underneath that burden, having complaints and lawsuits filed against them when what they're doing is, a job that has changed tremendously because of the big data that they now are responsible for and don't even really know how to deal with and haven't, nothing is really caught up, and I'm wondering how many decades it will take for that to happen.
Well, it's not something that I'm particularly expert in, but I'm relying on some sort of insight from, for example, an emergency room doc whose hospital just went through this transition, whose writing I'm familiar with. And the story that he tells is one, I think, that sounds self-serving, but that reinforces my point that one needs to think much earlier in the development process. Because the allegation that he makes in this piece that he's developing, not necessarily central to what he's writing, but that the software developers did not abide by some very basic criteria that are known, that are out there in terms of developing software for ease of users.
I think the whole electronic health record effort is an example of, in my judgment, poorly constructed public policy. We committed large amounts of funds before we decided what outcomes we wanted to achieve outside of some hand-waving over efficiency, and before we thought through what architecture for the system, because this is a system, not just a set of people on social media sites, that we wanted to, that was both technologically feasible and would give the results that we desire. And so I think it's a classic case that we would be better off with a little, part what David earlier argued, a little planning before we lurched into big expenditures and set of incentives, which, as you could predict from the beginning, I might add, is leading to a series of software stovepipes. And that's what the media are reporting. You have the vendor's interest is in selling their software. It's not actually making it interoperable. It's not necessarily leading to cost reductions. Another cost impact that's being reported casually in the press is it's giving it, making it easier for hospitals that weren't charging the maximum rate for their services to move the rates upward. Clinicians complain because the old written record had the advantage you could riffle through it and see what happened to that patient 20 years ago. Now, many of the systems don't look back more than 3 to 5 years, so they're stuck with what's there. What's there may be inadequate. All sorts of issues out there that I would argue, had we spent some time in the architectural design, back to David's plea for some planning money in these efforts, some scenario work, what might happen if we do some experimentation, in fact. Let's put baby versions in someone's hands and see what they actually do with it, which, back to the GPS example, might be very different than what we anticipate would help us. Yep. That said, we are where we are, and I think the issue is, what do you do now? Which I would acknowledge I have no prescription to offer you.
Don't have to go to an emergency room.
Well, the time is up. I want to thank our panelists for an excellent conversation, and thank you all for coming to this conference.